All right. So I won't pester you with a question yet, but we'll come back in a few minutes. Essentially what I'm asking is, what does it mean to be a partaker of the divine nature now? I mean, you can think about what it might mean in eternity, but there's something about now, we're already partakers of the divine nature, so it'd be nice to know some ideas about what that might mean. But we'll come back to that. I tried to shorten the schedule just to reflect the lessons that I'm responsible for teaching. Brigham is going to teach the last class. We are going to cover the book of Jude, among other things. So that, I guess I should have changed the TBD. The teacher is going to be Brigham, which is good. And I misunderstood entirely that he had recorded something for you at the end of 1 Peter 5. So if that was confusing because I did cover part of it last time, my apologies. I'm sure whatever Brigham said was correct. Whatever I said was lesser correct or whatever. But let's keep going. So this morning, if you look back at this, we do want to cover verses 3 through 21. So we're really trying to go through chapter 1 of 1 Peter. We'll go back to the introduction for just a minute, these first two verses. I think there's something very special about those. And so it's up here in two different translations, the English Standard Version and the New King James Version. And something about each one of those, the way that it's stated, that to me brings out something I think that's important. So think about this. Who do we say might be the ones, the ours, that are reflected or referenced here in the English Standard Version, with whom we, along with those who have written this letter, have equal standing in our faith? Who might be the ours?
The apostles.
It could be the apostles. It could be some of those who knew Christ, who were like the very foundational believers, if you will, but perhaps even the apostles. But the idea that the ones who received this letter there in some parts of Turkey and other parts of the world, perhaps a good number of Gentiles along with the Jews, that they had an equal standing. I think that's important to consider, that our faith as children of God doesn't put us in different tiers. And there's a lot of religious organizations that try to divide up the value of some believers who've made maybe a deeper commitment in some way, and so they have a higher standing than others who might also be of the same faith, but they really don't have the same standing in that faith, this idea of the equal part. What would that stand out to you in the New King James Version? What would seem a little bit different thought, but something of significance in the way that it expresses the faith that we have?
The preciousness?
I think the preciousness, this value. And we're going to come back and see that word again in regard to the promises and the value of things that God has given to us. And so we'll reflect on that a little bit. So these are just some things that come out in the initial part of it. There's one other thing, though, that we should note in the introduction because, now let's just go to the outline, and you'll see this in verse 1 and verse 2, or verse 2 rather, brings out a certain point. So we made a little bit of a light of the outline the last time, just the fact that we're not using the S's and some other things that Brigham had used in 1 Peter 1, or the first letter that Peter wrote. And it may be a little harder to follow this outline because it doesn't have something that kind of grabs your attention along the way. But here's what I want you to think about for a moment. What's the real problem that Peter is going to address? What is the, let's call it the reason why I've got to write this letter to you. What is it?
I mean, he's called.
What is he worried about for them? He is going to tell them, he's going to remind them, but is that really it? Like, I think you guys are beginning to lose your memory.
Well,
it's the false teaching, right? It's what's going to come that's likely to pull them away from God. That That's what he is. I'm really concerned about. Now, there's some ways you could structure dealing with that. If I'm really worried about something and I'm going to write to you about it, one way I might do is kind of like, you know, you call it bottom line writing. I'm put up at the top, you know. Second time that I'm writing to you, and I'm writing to you now because false teaching is coming. And put that danger point right up front. And then once I get it out there, then I'm going to tell you, now here's what you need to do to be ready for the false teaching. Now that's not the structure of this, but it's very clear that what he is most concerned about is this danger that's coming, the false teaching. But structurally what he does, I think, is that he describes what's going to keep you from falling into this false teaching. And there's really two things above all else, it seems to me, that he emphasizes. The first thing is the idea of knowledge. So look here in the introduction, look at verse 2 of the introduction. May grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. So the stress is made on knowledge right up front. But where he goes next, which is part of what we're going to cover this morning, is a description of the character that they need to have. And if you think about it for a moment, as you're reading the letter, if you haven't figured out yet what the danger is that he's worried about, what he's going to tell us is, if you'll just do this, if you'll keep your mind focused on becoming this kind of person, it will ensure that you're saved in the end. There's kind of like this absolute certainty. If you'll just grow in this manner, if you'll be this kind of person, everything's going to be okay. And I think that includes the idea that, you know what, false teachers will come, they'll tell you things, but if you're focused on doing this, you're not going to drift off into that false teaching. So the character, and it's not just who they should be, but it's the way in which they should be working at, constantly developing and deepening that character, is going to protect them. But then, it seems to me, it comes back to this knowledge again. You need to have confidence that the message that you've received is not something just made up by men. It's not a matter of interpretation. It's not a matter of opinion. It is something that you can know with absolute certainty. And that's going to become essential if somebody comes and tries to teach you something and pull you in different directions. You need to have confidence that these things are true. So we'll put it this way. So there's our outline. Of course, later he'll come back and remind them that the time is coming when the Lord's going to come and there's going to be a judgment, which is, I think, a call to action. You know, if you're in danger, remember what's going to happen later on. Don't let that danger pull you away and cause you to miss out when the Lord comes again. So there is an admonition, a push toward diligence, if you will, and all of that. Any questions, thoughts about the outline? There's some different ways of viewing it, but I think that just understanding there's a danger he's going to talk about, but he lays the foundation up front to address it, is important. All right. So again, here are the two safeguards against false teaching. One is knowledge, to really understand what is the truth, to have confidence in it, the message that you've heard. But the second one is to have the right kind of character. Not just that you possess it, but that you're working on constantly developing it as well. Those are the things that will protect us in all of this. Alright, so let's talk about these precious and great promises, and then we'll come back to the question that I posed to you at the beginning. Jason McIlvain, do you mind reading this for us?
His divine power is granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire.
Okay. Isn't that a wonderful passage? You know, this is just one of those that we should come back to constantly and remind ourselves of what God thinks of us, what God wants for us. Two words that we might pull out of this as we kind of break this apart a little bit. Notice the word granted that's there. It says it twice, verse 3, His divine power is granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. Come back and think about the knowledge part in a moment. But in verse 4, by which He has granted to us His precious and great promises. All right, so the granted, I tried to look this up. I thought, you know, that sounds a lot like the idea of grace. And it really is. The granted is the idea of freely given. It's not like this is something you've earned, you've worked toward, you've been involved. It's like here you are, you've just been granted this. Think about a grant that you give. You don't have to pay that back, right? This is a freely given thing. So on the one hand, here's this idea of being given something freely. Well, you know, sometimes we toss out free things, you know. You go somewhere and get a free pen. Well, that's great. I got 43 other pens back home, right? But here, what is he saying has been granted to us?
Divine power.
That's what have been granted. What have we been granted?
All things to pertain to life and godliness.
Imagine that. All things that pertain to life and to godliness. Just freely given. That's not all. What's the other part he talks about being granted?
Precious and I guess the promises.
Precious. And so I looked that up too. It's like this idea of something of great value. So you get freely given, but we're being given things that they're inestimable in terms of their value. How would you put a price on it, Chad?
Well, and he's granted us, and it's the all things. There's nothing lacking. He's given us everything. It's a little reminiscent of what Jude says in Jude verse 3 about the faith that was once delivered. He's given us all things.
That's great. Yeah, I think all of this is just a wonderful thought. And in it, he says, and we're going to come back to this idea, first of all, how did he do it in verse 3? How did he manage to give us all things pertaining to life and to godliness?
Through the knowledge of Him.
It's through the knowledge. And so the value of knowing something, of learning something, of listening, and grasping what God wants us to understand is extremely important. And of course, we're going to lead up again to chapter 2 and talk about false teaching. So having that knowledge is really important. And it's going to call us to His own glory and excellence. So keep that thought in mind too, the idea of glory and excellence, because that's a description of God. And in a moment, we're going to talk about being partakers of the divine nature. The other thing I want you to notice here is when he says in verse 4 that we would become partakers of the divine nature, what also has happened for us? What's the thought that follows? Okay, well, you can be a partaker of the divine nature. What else has happened for us? Yeah, we've escaped something. You know, it's we've been granted something, but it's also the idea of before we were prisoners, we were trapped or something. Because now we have escaped, he says, the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. All right, so these are these great promises and things that he's telling us that we can have, a description of the kind of people that we can be. This is true of all of us. As children of God, this is a description of where we are, of what has been granted to us, and we should value and treasure it. So, here's the thought. I'll put the question back up and then I'm going to turn back to the passage. I think you can remember the question here. I'm asking then if we're promised this ability to be, you know, now partaker of God's divine nature through His promises. What does that mean? What do you think it means to be a partaker of the divine nature? Let's see if we can think of some specific ways in which we partake in God's nature now. What do you think? Yes.
Focusing on that last part where he talks about escaping corruption, I mean, maybe it's like being holy as He's holy. I'm thinking about like Romans 7 and 8, where Paul talks about being imprisoned in the flesh, and then at the end he's like, who will set me free?
Jesus
Christ.
Yeah.
And then he goes into how we're free.
That's excellent, Colin. Yeah. Yeah, so part of this is just the idea that we're becoming separated from the world and separated from those things that have pulled at us before in this partaking of God's nature. What else comes to mind? Carl.
The one that stands out to me is life. I mean, this world is about death and decay. And we escape that. You know, through the knowledge of Him, we have life, and life that endures.
Oh, that's great.
It's momentary.
But it's life now.
Life
it's
now.
A richer life. It's a better life, right? Than what it would be if we were not.
Yeah, and the enduring life does start now. It's not life at some point in the future. It starts now.
Yeah, that's good. What else? What else do you see there?
Yeah, the fact that we are completely different, it brings me back to First Peter, that we are a chosen nation. So we're completely different mindset and not from the world. So we just divine nature.
Yeah, I think that mindset is something that's important. That we're partaking now of the divine nature. Part of it is what's actually changed within us, the way we see the world, the way we think of it. You know, that we have, if we have an eternal viewpoint of things, isn't that a godly viewpoint? Isn't that the viewpoint of God? To see things way beyond the limitation of now. But if we are caught up in the corruption that's part of the world, a lot of times it's just, man, it's only about tomorrow. It's about next week. It's about the next moment of pleasure, whatever. I'm really not thinking beyond this life. And I think that mindset is a description of some of that divine nature. You got 6 seconds, Jonas?
So maybe the idea about sinful desires. So we know from God's standpoint, He's not tempted.
Right.
He doesn't desire these things. And maybe sometimes we think about stop doing things. Well, maybe now in partaking, we're no longer desiring these things.
Right.
That, you know, because of this new mindset.
I think that's exactly right. Now, think about this. You are a partaker of the divine nature. It doesn't mean that right now that our nature becomes fully like God. I mean, we are still living in a world that is corrupted, but we've escaped from it. But isn't it true that over the course of our life as a Christian, as we grow, we're going to look at how to grow in just a moment, there's some things that once were such strong temptations pulling at us, meant were very difficult to deal with, and over time, they're not. It changes. You can become a different person where that's not the case anymore, and I think that's part of becoming a part of the divine nature, that temptation doesn't affect you, because you've described it as God's not moved by that. Well, we're becoming closer to God in that sense. Yeah.
So is that linked to the knowledge that we acquire? By having the knowledge, we are less attracted to the things that we used to be, being part of the nature of the sinful nature of men, and acquiring that, but through the knowledge.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's part of what ought to do that. You know, first of all, he points out that we're going to get all things pertaining to life and knowledge through the knowledge of Him, understanding of Him. So it is connected to it, but it is interesting that it's through the promises that we become partakers of the divine nature. And, of course, those promises are embedded in that knowledge, that understanding. This reliance upon God, what He's told us He's going to do, is what provokes us to change, to work toward that change. And I think to go through the process we're going to talk about now in just a moment about character. Any other thoughts? And we'll kind of move on to the idea of the character that we need to chat.
Well, slow down, but I think consistent with what's been said in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul says that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lust of deceit, that you may be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and put on the new self, which is the likeness of God, has been created in righteousness and holiness of truth. I think it's consistent with what we're talking about.
I appreciate you bringing that up. I heard a sermon on that just this week, and had those two thoughts in mind, and had really had forgotten where some of that extra thought came, but that picture of the new man in Ephesians 4. That's the section this year that Andy Cantrell is preaching on. Once every month, kind of the end part of chapter 4 and the chapter 5 of Ephesians. It's really good. All right. So I think this is all very, very helpful as we think this part through. And by the way, don't worry about slowing me down, because anything I don't manage to do falls to Brigham.
I'm not making it recorded.
What I should have to do. Lesson 12B or something like that. All right, so I know this is a Bill font. I appreciate you pointing that out. You'll understand why in just a moment, why I put this up here. But and perhaps James, being on the front row, James could read this and all. So we're going to move into this idea of the character. So he's encouraging us, in order to be ready, we've got to have a certain character. We want to talk about these Christian virtues that are described here coming up in verses 5 through 8. So James, can you read that?
Yes, okay.
No, that's great.
For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. For if these qualities are yours and are increasing, they keep you from being ineffective and unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Okay. So again, you notice that the idea of knowledge, of course, is important. It's one of those virtues. And he also talks at the end about, you know, if you've developed this character, you're not going to be unfruitful in that knowledge. So the knowledge that you have of Christ is actually going to be valuable to you and useful if you also supplement what you know with this effort of developing this right kind of character, as he's going to describe it. I will say, I think that this description of these virtues is a little intimidating to try to run through in a few minutes in a class. We have a whole class, a whole study, 13 lessons on the Christian virtues that are described here in this. So we could pull them out, we could make a great deal more about it. So I want you to kind of notice the connection of them. Before we start to list them, you see this statement in verse 5, and this is the English Standard Version. You'll get some slightly different ways of the way it'll be described. And if you have a different translation, you want to bring out some of the different wording along the way, that'd be great. The idea is that you're going to supplement your faith. So we're going to start with faith here, but we're going to supplement it with something else. And one thing I will stress, I do think that you can take each one of these and see a flow of how you begin with faith and how it can kind of lead to some of these other things. And I'm going to challenge you a little bit to kind of tell us what might be the flow of how you go from one to the other. But what I don't think he's describing here is the idea that a Christian begins with like a blank slate. And the first building block is, I get faith. Oh, now I got faith. What else do I need? I need some virtue. So you begin to kind of like add each one. I think that what's being described here is every child of God has a degree of everything we're going to talk about here. But what he's encouraging is kind of like this constant work to develop these characteristics in a deeper and richer fashion. And they'll flow out of the others, and we'll supplement one to the one that we have. But there is this connection that just kind of constantly goes. So we're going to make it into a circle, because when you go around and do it, you just start over, you just keep doing it. It's not like you suddenly finally say, whoa, I got the last one. I forget what the last one. I think the last one is love. Oh, added it, I'm done. I've finally put all the building blocks in place, and I haven't. It doesn't work that way. I think we have these qualities. But do we have them in the way that we really need to have them? So, why do you think he starts with faith, though?
The foundation.
It's so much the foundation, right? And I would say this too. He's going to talk about knowledge, which is interesting if you do it later. But could you have faith without knowledge? Without some of the things we've already talked about? You can have faith without any knowledge?
Well, I mean, no.
Yeah. Well, I'm going really.
That's right. But the scriptures are interesting in the way they present knowledge. You can know the things that you can't see. You can be confident. You can have faith and confidence in those things. What I really meant by knowledge is that without the message, without the information that God, what is it that I believe? Well, I need to be confident that Christ is the Lord. He's resurrected from the dead. That God is real, and that God's promises, and that all of that, I think, is embedded in knowledge. But it comes back to my faith, my confidence, my trust in God. And from that trust, then he says you would have virtue. Anybody got a different word there? Add to your faith something else other than virtue.
Moral excellence.
Moral excellence. I like the moral part. Anybody else? More than
goodness.
Goodness? Okay. So you get the idea that it's a little bit hard to kind of nail down exactly how to describe what this is. And as if to make it more confusing, when we do have this other class, we call it Christian virtues, of which one of the virtues is virtue. But here's the idea. It does have to do with the idea of excellence. So think of it as a high standard. I like the idea of moral excellence. I saw somewhere where the definition could even be like moral goodness. And here's what I think is in the general idea of this. To my faith, I'm going to add this quality of sincere, deep desire to do the right thing. Not kind of, not halfway. It's the idea of excellence. But it's the idea of moral excellence. What is right? What is the right thing to do in this moment? And whatever I can determine is truly the right thing to do, then that matters to me. That's a big deal. Why would that flow out of faith?
It's a byproduct.
It's a byproduct. I'm confident in God. And that's really from whom we would understand the standard of what's right and wrong. Well, because of that, then I'm really concerned about this. So to that virtue, that concern, let's just say that it's a concern. I want to do what's right. And I'm concerned about doing it as well as I can, the idea of excellence. Why would knowledge need to be something then that I would supplement, add to that desire to do what's right? Why does knowledge come back in and be so important?
There could be something that you're not doing right.
Okay, and how would I determine that I'm not doing what's right?
By the knowledge.
The knowledge would tell me. My understanding of God's will would help me to understand what really is right or not. And if I have this deep concern about doing what's right, well, then I'm going to want to know. And think about passages like, Hebrews 5, which really is saying that there's some things that you're not going to know that whether they're right or wrong simply by reading, because not everything is described there. But the knowledge that you gain, the solid food, the deeper part of the word, is for the mature who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. See why it would be so important to gain that knowledge? Because then I'm trying to really understand, even in those things that are hard to determine, what is the right thing, the best thing to do in this moment, Jack?
It's making me think of, we should certainly have knowledge to make sure we're not doing anything wrong, but I'm thinking more along the lines of Ephesians 5:10, trying to discern what's pleasing to Him. You want that knowledge so you can live your best way to please Him, and with that positive spin on it.
That's great. I always love these things. I know that's one of Jack's favorite passages. Yeah, it's a great one to bring in into that thought. All right, so then from knowledge, we would gain a degree of self-control. And consider this for a moment. What do you think is the flow? Why would self-control kind of flow out of this knowledge? Any ideas there?
Well, you see the self-control of Jesus.
Okay. So you see some examples of that and other things. Yeah. And it's not so much as just this. You can go back to this desire to do what is right. And now that you understand more of what that is, that motivates you
to have the kind of self-control. And self-control, you know, the ability to have a limit over our anger, over our emotions, over our sexual desire, whatever they may be, we become the ones who are in control of those